Great. Thank you for all of you for coming out. I'm reporting on the exact same study that Melissa just described to you, except I'm using it in a very different way and for a very different purpose. So to get us started, knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs about mental illnesses and why they're important is what I want to talk to you about. And I'm going to give you a theory about why such knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs about mental illnesses affect people with mental illnesses. And then I'm going to present to you analyses probing the origins of these knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs in use embedded in social and cultural contexts. And I'll look at socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity and gender, school, and then have a special focus on the family because we have unusual data about family-kid relationships. So here's the theory. This is a theory a long time, has been around for quite a while. Call it modified labeling theory. I've got the pictures of my co-authors there, and it happens today that one of them's in the room, the winner of the LaPousse Award from the mental health section, Patrick Schrout. But it was a theory designed to account for disadvantaged outcomes in the absence of blatant person-to-person discrimination between people. So that studies had tried to examine the effect of one person doing something to another person and that harming them. And those studies around mental illness showed effects, but the reported incidence of that kind of direct person-to-person rejection were low. And the differences between people with mental illnesses and others with respect to major outcomes were large. So how do you explain why it is that that occurs? So this theory is to try to say why people with mental illnesses can be disadvantaged even in the absence or even when direct person-to-person discrimination is not involved. And the idea is that ambient beliefs about whether most people will devalue and discriminate against people with mental illness have become personally relevant when mental illness develops and official labeling occurs. So to make that very concrete, you can imagine Bruce Link 1 and Bruce Link 2. And Bruce Link 1 and Bruce Link 2 grow up in the same cultural context. And we all learn about what other people think about people with mental illnesses, whether they would look down on them, not want to hire them, fear that they do something violent. And we both grow up in that cultural context. But Bruce Link 1, at some point in his life, develops a mental illness, gets officially labeled by treatment status and the like. And so all of a sudden, all those beliefs that Bruce Link 1 had are personally relevant. Maybe people won't want to interact with me. Maybe people will look down on me. So it becomes personally relevant. For Bruce Link 2, people think this about mental illness, but I've never developed a mental illness, not relevant to me, has no impact on me. So that's the theory. And if you're Bruce Link 1, there are consequences. Immediately, you might feel bad when you realize you've developed a mental illness. You might feel depressed, fearful, ashamed because these beliefs have become personally relevant. And you might engage in coping efforts like trying to keep it a secret, withdrawing from others because you fear they might reject them. And so on. Some of those coping mechanisms could be harmful to you. If you don't ask for a date because you're afraid that someone would reject you, if you don't ask for a job because you fear someone wouldn't want to hire you, and so on. And then finally, if you think other people might look down on you, it can impair your performance. So imagine yourself going into a situation where you think other people might reject you about something about you, rather than you go and you think everybody's going to think you're great. In those two different situations, you're going to perform better or worse. So that's the theory. And a central driver in this theory is, the cultural beliefs that become personally relevant. So we're interested in figuring out where do those come from and where in the life course do those come from. These are some of the consequences the theory have been related to. Unemployment and income loss, smaller social networks, how you feel about the quality of your life, depressive symptoms, whether you feel demoralized, delays in going to get help for problems that you have, and your self-esteem, how you feel about yourself. Where do these come from? Well, you can think about socialization in particular, and the theory kind of says socialization must be important. That must be where it comes from. But, there haven't been that many studies trying to unpack that and find out exactly where it comes from and maybe where we can go do something about it. So I'm going to look at some of these things, but really focus on the family and the attitudes of the parents and the attitudes of the kids. So if it is socialization, what kind of data structures would we need to see that? It might be socialization. You know, we'd want data from a critical period of socialization, you know, when people are trying to figure out these you know, what it is, mental illness is and so on. And then longitudinal data so as to probe development of knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs over time, just watch it happening. And then you'd want to have measures of parents and children to provide evidence about sort of the intergenerational transmission. What do the parents tell their kids, and what do the kids get? And maybe what do the kids tell the parents, and what do the parents get? So this is the Texas school intervention study that you heard Melissa describe. I put up Chris Painter there, who's going to actually later on today present the main findings, the central findings of this intervention study. Melissa was doing one outcome, and I'm doing this stuff about the intergenerational transmission. Just if you were all here, you just heard about it. It's sixth grade classes, random assignment of schools to interventions, and the children are assessed at pre-intervention, post-intervention, and then 6, 12, 18, and 24 months later. So it's really kind of novel data in that sense, about stigma anyway. And then the caregivers, and this is the part that's really different about what I'm going to report. We assess the caregivers, mainly the parents, at 6, 12, and 18 months. So there's the sample. You've already heard that described. Now, this, let me say a little bit about this follow-up sample of the children and the caregivers, because that Melissa didn't describe. About 430 families agreed to participate in the follow-up study. That is at 6, 12, 18, and 24 months. And the families that agreed were similar to those who did not in terms of the age, gender, and education. Latino families, it turned out, were slightly more likely to participate in the follow-up than other families. And then referring to my colleague here who does the main lifting on the data collection, I mean, she does really well. 90% of those who were interviewed at 6 months were re-interviewed at 12 months, and 91% of those at 12 months were re-interviewed at 18 months. So the follow-up is fairly good. And the novel data structure we created is parents and children assessed with comparable measures in a longitudinal design at a critical period in which attitudes are forming. We received a competitive supplement to our NIH grant about stigma to exploit this data structure and to expand it to include race in the 24-month follow-ups. And it gives us an unusual chance to look at the intergenerational transmission of knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs. This is something that has not been done before, really, around mental illness. And I'm going to report preliminary results on this. We're just getting the data in. We've only gotten to 18 months. And just one measure, social distance. And this is the guy who developed this measure for children, Otto Wall. And here are the items that are in it. Would it be okay with you? Definitely yes, probably no, and definitely no. To make friends with someone with mental illness, have someone with mental illness as a neighbor, sit next to someone with mental illness in class, you get the idea. And it's then adapted for the parents so that when it's about a child, they ask, would it be okay with you to have your child eat lunch in school with someone who has a mental illness? And this is multiple waves, and the parents and the kids, and it always has a pretty good reliability. And just give you some descriptives about the social distance from the children's point of view. This is the percent saying that they definitely know or probably know, would they be willing to make friend, neighbor, eat lunch, sit next to, class project, invite home. And it's interesting, we assess the kids on their mental health status, so a lot of them have mental health problems. A lot of them don't want to sit next to anybody, but actually a lot of them are sitting next to people who do have mental health problems. Anyway, that's one way of looking at it, and you can see that, you know, if you're a person with has a mental health problem, you know, about 2 out of 5 of your colleagues don't want to invite you to their home. But another way of looking at it, I just put in, you know, the definitely yes bars, the reddish bars there. And here you see that, you know, very few, never a majority say, definitely, a sure, I'll invite the kid home. So what we have here is really an array from, you know, no, I don't want that to happen at all. Yeah, maybe, but probably not. Yeah, maybe a little bit, but, and then definitely less, you know, yes, only a minority. So that gives you a picture of sort of where the kids are. This is pre-intervention. And here's just some data about some descriptives about, you know, the potential of the family context with respect to SES influencing the kids' social distance attitudes. And there's a little gradient there, and I'll emphasize a little gradient there. It's not very strong. It is significant, but it's really kind of a modest effect. There's gender. It's also, there's also effect there. The girls are a little nicer, you know, a little not something that you might expect. But again, it's not a very big effect. It's something suggesting, you know, the girls and boys sort of do go up in different cultures, and you might expect that to be expressed in how they think about mental illness and whether they'd be accepting of someone with mental health problems. But it's not a huge effect, again. And this race, ethnicity, this is self-reported, but later we're going to have stuff that's not subject to social desirability bias. We're going to have implicit attitudes. But these are explicit. The whites report less social distance than the other three groups. So that, and you could think about those as being potential contextual things, and there's a little bit going on there, but not a whole lot going on there. With respect to school, these are all the schools just arrayed with the average social distance from the lowest to the highest. And that's, you know, that's fairly sizable differences. And I thought, you know, this is the school context, and, you know, so maybe that's really important. I'm kind of uncertain that it's really the school context, because I also ran the parents' attitudes by school, and that's even stronger, and the parents aren't in the school. So, it's probably something else about who goes to those schools rather than the school context itself. But that needs to be probed more and needs better data than I have. So now I want to tell you about this unusual circumstance that we have, our association between parents and kids' social distance. So we have each of them measured at multiple points in time. So here's just at the beginning point, I took the parents, put them in four groups so we could look at the bar chart. So they're either the lowest quartile, the next highest quartile, so to the top quartile. And there you see a gradient, and this is early on when the kids are in sixth grade, before the intervention and so on. And there's a modest effect there. The interesting thing, though, is we can look at this over time. And so this is translating the parent to the kid correlation on social distance at the different time points. So the thing there you can look at is that it's growing over time, you know, pretty substantially from 0.15, explaining 2.3% of the variance, to 9.5, substantially higher by the 18th month point, and just sort of, you know, regularly going up. This really intrigued me. And, you know, I would have liked it to look really dramatic, and I can't say that it looks super dramatic in that little picture, because this is the child social distance at the baseline, which I already showed you, and this is the gradient at the child social distance at 18 months. So this one is steeper. It's hard to sort of see it in the graph, but it is steeper if you attend to it carefully. So it's grown over time. And, you know, there's another kind of hopeful thing in it, that all the bars have gone down a little bit. Life's okay. The social distance has gone down over time. And then in multiple regression on data at the 18 months with age, gender, ethnicity, parental, education, and school dummy variables also entered, the parental social distance has by far the largest effect on child-reported social distance. It's above and beyond all the others. It's substantially the most important. But then we can ask who influenced who. And this needs to be probed further, but the question is, perhaps kids influence their parents as well as parents their kids, and I want to investigate this a little bit so that I'm going to show you something now. that helps us have a chance of looking at, you know, who's influencing who. I'm not fully convinced by what I'm about to show you, but it is evidence that's interesting. So it's a structural equation model with cross-lag association of parent and child-reported social distance. These are standardized coefficients, and what you can see, what you're looking at there is, here's the child social distance, and you know, predicting forward to see, you know, what's driving and producing that that coefficient over time. And you can see in the first, we're looking at these arrows, the influence of the kids on the caregivers, and then the influence of the caregivers on the kids. The influence of the caregivers on the kids is consistently there in the two time points. It seems to be fairly strong in from the 6 month to the 12 month, and then not so strong, or not even there perhaps, from the child at 12 months to the caregiver at 18 months. We want to do more with this, try to develop this further, but the idea that this kind of influence is going on to produce the larger correlation and make this intergenerational effect come to be is what we're aiming to do. So here are my summary and conclusions. We were interested in the origins of public knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs because of their demonstrated importance for the life chances of people with mental illness in that theory that I started you with. Our data provided an unusual opportunity to study the intergenerational transmission of such attitudes. We found that parental social distancing attitudes to be relatively strong predictors of child social distancing attitudes. This finding informed us about one potential source of the general social conceptions that are the starting point for that modified labeling theory I described to you. And then further, since our evidence shows that the parent-child association grew during the period of observation, our results identify this period as a potentially important period in which to intervene. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Oh, my collaborators.